William Clark called his expedition a vast enterprise. Years later, the scholarly investigation of Lewis and Clark is itself a vast undertaking. And perhaps no one has undertaken more of that task than my guest, James Rhonda. Rhonda, the Barnard Chair in Western History at the University of Tulsa, is a specialist in the exploration of the American West. His numerous books include Lewis and Clark Among the Indians and Voyages of Discovery, a collection of essays on the Lewis and Clark expedition. Rhonda has served as a consultant for numerous museum projects, including the Library of Congress Lewis and Clark Exploration Exhibition. Professor Rhonda, welcome.
Good morning. It's a delight and pleasure to be with you this morning.
The Lewis and Clark expedition was Thomas Jefferson's idea. Clark called him the main character. What did Jefferson hope to accomplish?
Well, I think one way to begin to answer that question is to talk about what Jefferson didn't want them to do. Textbook wisdom always says that Lewis and Clark went west to explore the Louisiana Purchase. Of course, that's exactly what they weren't supposed to do. The expedition was planned long before the Louisiana Purchase. Jefferson was very clear to Lewis and Clark, but certainly to Lewis, about what this expedition was all about. In June 1803, when Thomas Jefferson wrote exploration instructions for Meriwether Lewis, he said very clearly that the object of your mission is to find the most direct and practical water communication across this continent for the purposes of commerce. Now, that's Thomas Jefferson's way to talk about the Northwest Passage. Nothing is more powerful and more elusive in the history of the geographic exploration of North America than the Northwest Passage, that notion that there was a water communication between Atlantic and the Pacific. From the age of Columbus to Thomas Jefferson and beyond, this was the great dream, that a water passage could be found. So this expedition has one central core mission: find the Northwest Passage. And interestingly enough, during the first winter outside of St. Louis, when Meriwether Lewis suggests that maybe it would be interesting for him to take a little side trip towards Santa Fe, Thomas Jefferson quickly and sharply reins him in and says, no, your mission is single. Find the water passage. So at the heart of this journey is a central core mission: find the Northwest Passage. But Lewis and Clark didn't go into the West wearing intellectual blinders. Jefferson always believed that exploration had one mission and then many secondary missions. And when we read the instructions, we can find a long list of those secondary missions. Everything from astronomy and botany to zoology to ethnography to commercial relationships with native people. So there's a core mission, and then there are the secondary missions. And then after the Louisiana Purchase is announced, there's a slight change in the instructions. Now Lewis and Clark have a particular diplomatic mission among native people, and that's to announce the presence of a new great father. So Jefferson had a core mission, many secondary missions, and then after the purchase, a new diplomatic mission as well. This is a fairly grand undertaking, to find the passage, to do all of these other things. This suggests a kind of flexible program for exploration that Lewis and Clark are given by Thomas Jefferson.
Jefferson was, of course, an 18th century man of science, and you've written that for its time, the Lewis and Clark expedition was what would come to be known as big science, involving several institutions, many specialists, and substantial funding.
Well, I think the real model for this, because Jefferson had read widely in the history of exploration, and he looked especially at what the British were doing, because this is not the age of Lewis and Clark. This is the age of Cook and Vancouver. And Jefferson looked at what the British were doing in the Pacific Ocean. He looked particularly at one person, at Sir Joseph Banks. Banks was the president of the Royal Society. He was the principal scientific advisor to the government of George III. And what the British had done was to build a very complex, well-funded, highly structured model for global exploration. And Thomas Jefferson would attempt to do that same sort of thing. I've often talked about this as the people who made the journey and then those folks who made the journey possible. And we should focus especially on those folks who make the journey possible. They're the ones who helped Jefferson write the instructions, members of his cabinet, scientific friends in Philadelphia. But they're also in a whole nother group of folks, the ordinary craftsmen and artisans in Philadelphia and other places who don't make the journey, but who make the journey possible. I was thinking the other day about one particular person. Her name was Matilda Chapman, and she sewed the shirts for the expedition in Philadelphia. And she reminds me over and over again of all of those craftsmen and craftswomen who made those things that the journey would really be built on. So this is a large, complex structure, a large organization, people who make the journey, people who make the journey possible. And then, of course, there are what happens when the journey returns. And all of those folks who are going to look at the maps, at the specimens, at the journals, and think through what this journey is all about. A long time ago, Donald Jackson said that it was no longer useful to think about the journey of Lewis and Clark as the story of two men. And what I've tried to do in my writing is to give this story a large cast of characters and to give it a continental and even perhaps a global stage. So not just two men, but many characters, those who make the journey, those who make the journey possible.
I like the way you describe the men who accompany Lewis and Clark on the expedition. Your words are, they're a wild bunch of hard-drinking, brawling, and insubordinate rowdies. Doesn't sound very promising.
Well, I think they're a bunch of tough customers. And if you think about where Lewis and Clark recruited those who were going to go along with them, some of them indeed come from frontier infantry companies. They are soldiers. But some of them are French boatmen, and then some of them are frontier hunters. So they come from disparate and different social groups. And what Lewis, Clark, and the senior sergeant, John Ordway, what these three men need to do is to create what in military terms is called unit cohesion. What they need to do is to create a military community, what Meriwether Lewis would eventually call the best of families. That's a very interesting phrase, the best of families. And that didn't happen automatically. It was a long, hard struggle to weld together these often difficult and rowdy characters into something that would be cohesive, a unit that would understand its mission, and then work together for the common good. And if we look at how they did that, first, they do it by imposing military discipline, by the rules and regulations, the culture of a military unit. But that's not enough. This group is going to work only if it has shared common experiences. The experiences of living together, working together, eating together, sharing a common life. And that's really what happens in that first year, is that this tough bunch of characters, I don't know that necessarily they have the right stuff right away. They need to find the common center. They need to find the common ground. They need to have a shared life. And that's really what happens in that first year, in that shakedown cruise up the Missouri from St. Louis to Fort Mandan. They learn to live together as a human community. And I like to tell my students, that's what this expedition is. It's a human community that comes to know itself.
It also comes to know other people. One of Jefferson's secondary missions, of course, is to establish diplomatic relations with the Indians. What preconceptions did he and what preconceptions did Lewis and Clark, too, for that matter, have about the Native Americans?
I think the images cover a wide range. On one hand, Jefferson sometimes thought about Native people as children living at the dawn of time. And if you wanted to understand something about the origins of European civilization, you ought to look at the way Native people live, because Jefferson believed in a kind of social evolution, that all human societies began as hunting societies and then, in his mind, progressed eventually to the most perfect societies, farming societies. So Jefferson thought sometimes that Native people were children living at the dawn of time. So that's That's on one end of the spectrum. They're children. Children who eventually might, so Jefferson hoped, commit cultural suicide and then become just like their European neighbors. On the other end of that, there are much harder, much tougher, much more violent images. Images of Native people as treacherous savages. And Meriwether Lewis oftentimes talks about Indians in terms of that one word, treachery. He draws on images from the violence of the Ohio Country Indian Wars of the 1780s, of the dark and bloody ground. And he'll talk about Indians as being treacherous savages, as being beasts. So we've got a full range of images here. But I think it's also important when we talk about images that these images oftentimes break down, and that on the journey, members of the expedition encounter Native people as human beings, and that they relate one to the other as human beings, sharing a common life, sharing a game, sharing a song, sharing a story, sharing a meal, giving gifts to each other. So while I always think it's important to understand preconceptions, images that exist before the journey, lots of times those images break down as one human being encounters and talks to and meets with another human being. But what we've got here is a full range of preconceptions.
Let's take it from the other directions. You've written that, in a sense, Lewis and Clark were exploring the Indians, but the Indians were exploring them as well.
Right. I think that's really what's going on here. I think that's the heart of the story, is that this is mutual encounter, this is mutual discovery, and that if Lewis and Clark and the others in the traveling party are explorers, then we need to get off the boat and get on the bank, and we need to see this through the eyes of Native explorers. Lewis and Clark are the strange country. They're the strangers. How do we explore them? Native people in different parts of the American West had had a lot of experience with outsiders, with strangers, with Euro-Americans. And so the response to the presence of Lewis and Clark is always based on previous experience. Mandans and Hidatsas up in present-day North Dakota around the Knife River had a lot of experience with Euro-American outsiders. And so they're going to have one set of reactions. They will, by the way, be very surprised about one kind of outsider they'd never seen. They'd never seen an African-American. They'd never seen anyone like York. So they'll be very surprised about that. In the center of the journey with the Shoshones, the Lemhi Shoshones had not seen these Euro-American outsiders. So there was real surprise and real wonder about these strangers. Then on the northwest coast, among the Chinooks, among the Clatsops, they too had seen strangers. They'd seen the maritime fur traders. They were a little concerned about these strangers are coming from the wrong direction. They're coming from the Columbia, not from the ocean. But they too had seen outsiders before. So when we think about Native people as explorers, because that's what they are, we always need to ask, what were the previous experiences that they'd had with outsiders, with strangers? And what are the strategies that Native American explorers used to explore Lewis and Clark? Everything from visiting, trading, talking, looking, and maybe even intimate encounters as well. Again, I like to talk about this story as the American encounter, as mutual exploration.
Sacagawea is, for a lot of people, I think, one of the most famous American women. How does the historical record match the myth?
I think the historical record is fairly thin about her. We know some things, and I'm afraid that very often, because we're so eager to know about her, she is such a compelling young person, this young mother with a child who makes the journey, that oftentimes we fill in the spaces with myth and with story and an invention. She is important, and she's important on a couple of levels. She's important first in a geographic sense because at key moments she identifies important geographic points. She's been to the Three Forks of the Missouri. That's part of her home country. She identifies as a guide a couple of key places. And then, of course, she's a language interpreter among her own people, the Lemhi Shoshones. And then there's something else, something that William Clark talks about. Her very presence, her physical presence, says to Native people that these travelers are not warriors, because a war party would never take along a woman and a child. And so her physical presence is important. And also, one of the rare moments when we hear her voice, when they're on the Pacific Ocean and a great whale is beached, and she wants to go and see that whale, because this is the great fish, and she makes it clear that she's made this journey along with them, and now it's her opportunity to see the ocean and to see the whale, because after all, as she says, I've made this journey, and I want to see this great thing. And that's an interesting moment when we can actually hear the voice of this young woman and her own curiosity about the world around her. You know, I think that in many ways she is a symbol for all of the women, both Native and non-Native, who make this journey possible, whether it's someone like Matilda Chapman or the Nez Perce woman, Watkuwis, who tells the Nez Perce to do Lewis and Clark no harm, or the Shoshone women who carry the baggage across the continental divide. Sacagawea reminds us that this is not just a guy story. This is not, oh, beautiful for spacious guys. That this is a story of both men and women. And she's a powerful reminder of that, I think.
Well, Professor Rhonda, thanks so much for visiting with us this morning.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with James Rhonda, the author of numerous books about Lewis and Clark, including Lewis and Clark Among the Indians and Beyond Lewis and Clark, The Army Explores the West.